Hello and welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau. I'm the chairman of the Department of History at Creighton University, and I'll be your host for this program. This week's History in the News involves that most popular of American presidents, Teddy Roosevelt, and his famous charge up San Juan Hill. In an article titled Charge, TR's Backers Target Medal of Honor, the Associated Press reports that a group of Roosevelt admirers led by Theodore Roosevelt Association of Oyster Bay on Long Island in New York is gearing up to fight a new battle of San Juan Hill, to have Roosevelt awarded the Medal of Honor he was denied immediately following that historic event, in time for its centennial celebration in 1998. The battle, you'll recall, fought in 1898, made Roosevelt a national hero and helped pave the way to the White House. A week after the Spanish-American War began, Roosevelt resigned as Assistant Secretary of the Navy and helped form the first U.S. Volunteer Cavalry, soon to be known as the Rough Riders. In their charge up San Juan Hill, Roosevelt was nicked in the elbow by a Spanish bullet, and his glasses were shot off. The hill was nevertheless taken, and after the war, Roosevelt's commanding officers nominated him for the nation's highest military honor. The Army, however, balked. Some say it was because his gallantry wasn't extraordinary enough. Others attribute it to his politics. While he was in the Army, they point out, Roosevelt offended a number of important people. First, he and other Army officers signed a letter to the Secretary of War urging that his troops be evacuated after the Battle of San Juan Hill because they were being decimated by malaria and other tropical diseases. The letter was given to the press, embarrassing then-President McKinley, but Roosevelt denied he had actually leaked it. Secondly, he was accused of orchestrating what detractors believed was an unseemly campaign for the Medal of Honor. Well, in response to this latest initiative, Roosevelt's biographer Edmund Morris is quoted as having said, "It seems to me a just effort because there's no question he was a very brave man, and bravery is something that Congress has always recognized, sooner or later. I think he was denied the medal," Morris concluded, "simply because he trumpeted his own bravery so much." And by the way, if T.R. were to at long last receive the Medal of Honor, he would be the only president to have both that medal and the Nobel Peace Prize, which he won in 1906 when he brokered the peace settlement ending the Russo-Japanese War. Stay tuned for the results. And as to this week in history, we can report that on November 12, 1927, with the expulsion of Leon Trotsky from the Communist Party, Joseph Stalin took full control of the Soviet Union. On November 12, 1954, Ellis Island closed after 62 years as New York's immigrant depot. The New York Harbor Island was the first stop in America for more than 20 million immigrants to the United States. On November 14, 1881, Charles Guiteau went on trial for the shooting death of President James Garfield. Guiteau was convicted and executed. On November 15, 1777, the Continental Congress approved the Articles of Confederation, the first governing document for the newly established United States of America. The articles were replaced a decade later by the Constitution. And on November 16, 1959, a new musical opened on Broadway featuring the antics of a spirited governess who trains a troupe of Austrian children to sing before falling in love with their father and fleeing Nazi Germany. The musical, The Sound of Music, by Rodgers and Hammerstein. The major segment of our show today deals with an event that occurred 40 years ago last month. In October 1957, the Soviet Union launched the first satellite into orbit, the impact of which was felt for decades on both sides of the Iron Curtain. To lead us in our exploration of that event, I'd like to introduce Robert Hopkins, another member of Creighton's Department of History, who will be interviewing historian John L. Gaddis. Robert?
Thank you, Brian. On October 4, 1957, Americans were crowded in front of their television sets watching the premiere of ABC's new comedy, Leave It to Beaver. The idyllic lifestyle the show portrayed could easily apply to most Americans, who viewed the world around them with confidence and, perhaps, a sense of naivete. an innocuous news announcement about another event on October 4th, however, shattered that illusion.
As a result of intensive work by research institutes and designing bureaus, the first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
The Soviet Union's launch of Sputnik, a name which ironically meant fellow traveler, an American euphemism for a communist sympathizer, had a profound effect on America. Here to discuss Sputnik's influence is the distinguished Yale University professor, John Lewis Gaddis. Professor Gaddis's most recent book, We Now Know, Rethinking Cold War History, and published by Oxford University Press, offers an insightful glimpse into our past and its meaning for today. Welcome, Professor Gaddis.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Good, good. Professor Gaddis, what's really the story here? Americans have become so jaded with space shuttles, things on Mir, man on the moon. Why was the launch of a little satellite in 1957 so traumatic for Americans?
Well, I think you have to remember that it was in the context of the Cold War. It was in the context of a period when we felt a real sense of danger, something that really extended back to our experience with Pearl Harbor. That memory was still very much alive. And what was striking about Sputnik was that for the first time, Americans realized that their own country, their own homes, could be vulnerable to a Soviet missile attack, because the same missile that launched Sputnik could have been capable of launching a nuclear warhead that could have reached the United States. So it made a tremendous impact.
So the initial response was not so much that it was a scientific coup or an engineering coup, but it was a potential military accomplishment that really put the United States at a strategic disadvantage.
Absolutely. It was very scary. I can cite myself as a primary source in this regard, because I can remember as a teenager the night that the thing went up and it was announced that you could see it at a certain time in the sky, climbing to the roof of the house and looking up, and indeed, you could see not the satellite, but you could see the rocket casing tumbling with the sun reflecting off of it. And in the context of the Cold War, that was a very scary thing indeed, because we just didn't have that sense of vulnerability until this development occurred.
How did the Soviet people react to this? We have this perception that the world is suddenly destabilized because of Sputnik. Was there a different reaction in the Soviet Union?
Well, of course, the reaction was one of great pride, I think, in the achievement. The Soviets had been so long, and it had been so painful for them to recover from the war. There had always been the sense of being behind the West in scientific and technological developments, and here was an area where they zoomed ahead of the West. And, of course, the Soviet leader at that point, Nikita Khrushchev, was not shy and modest in the way in which he trumpeted this triumph.
So how did he play that triumph? Was it mostly oriented towards just superpower or bipolar politics, or was he able to exploit that in terms of third-world opinion of the Soviet Union?
Well, he played it in a way that became part of his overall strategy, I think, toward the West in general, not just third-world opinion, for the next 4 or 5 years or so. He tried to parlay this undoubted scientific achievement into giving everyone the impression that, in fact, Soviet missile capabilities were a lot stronger than they were. What's important to remember is that although the rocket that launched Sputnik indeed could have carried a nuclear warhead, they didn't have enough rockets to be able to launch a significant first strike on the United States, and never did at any point coming up through the Cuban Missile Crisis. But Khrushchev gave the appearance through his own rhetoric, through his own boasting, that they did. And in the absence of intelligence information, not available to average citizens, no one knew any better.
Right. You described that in your book. You called that Potemkinism, where the Soviet leaders would attempt to convince the world of something that really wasn't the case. Do you think that Potemkinism, for example, may have been responsible not so much for the space race? John Kennedy, of course, very enthusiastic about that. But do you think that Potemkinism, Sputnik in general, may have contributed to an unexpected and rather abrupt acceleration of the arms race?
Well, I think it did, in the sense that the whole idea of the missile gap, the idea that the West and the United States particularly was behind the Soviet Union in the means of delivering weapons, i.e. ICBMs, certainly takes hold and becomes a major issue in the wake of the Sputnik launch. This dramatizes, first of all, the significance of missiles, which I think had not dawned on the average citizen until Sputnik went up. And secondly, because it took the Americans another 3 to 4 months to get their own satellite up, and because the Russians remained ahead of us in what they could launch into orbit, the size of their payloads, there was the perception that we were behind in missile strength. So, yes, that was a major expansion, it seems to me, of the arms race in this last half of the 1950s.
After John Kennedy was elected, Nikita Khrushchev supposedly told Americans that thanks to keeping American flyers who had been shot down captive and prisoner, that he, Khrushchev, had helped get Kennedy elected. Do you think that, looking back even farther, that Sputnik helped get John Kennedy elected by giving him a cause celebre or something to hang his political hat on, his rhetoric to use in the 1960 campaign?
Sure. Kennedy made a big issue of the Missile Gap in the run-up to the election, in the campaign itself. It's always hard with an election to say that any one thing resulted in victory of the party that won. But I think surely the perception that the Eisenhower administration had let American defenses slide was one that put Nixon at a disadvantage in the campaign, and certainly was one of the things that gave a boost to Kennedy.
You addressed this very briefly in your book, and I'd like to take the liberty of sitting on this side of the mic and putting you on the spot. Could you speculate for us? Could you really try and take a stab at why it was that Eisenhower so badly botched this? Why did he allow this to reach the level of hysteria almost that it did when he knew full well that this wasn't true and he just did not succeed in quelling American anxieties?
Well, there are two different takes on that question, the perception at the time and the perception of the initial historians who assessed this, was that yes, indeed, Eisenhower did botch it because the actual threat was not as great as it was. We, in fact, never were that significantly behind the Russians, and we quickly zoomed out ahead of the Russians in missile capabilities. And the argument is that Eisenhower botched it by not making this clear to the American people. But historians more recently have looked at this and said that Eisenhower was perhaps wiser than we might have thought in the way that he handled it. His difficulty was this, that the intelligence sources that were available to us at the time were the U-2 reconnaissance flights over the Soviet Union. They were producing only partial information. It would not be until about 1959 or so that there was enough to begin to suggest that Khrushchev's claims were vastly inflated. That was finally confirmed when satellite reconnaissance begins in 1960 and certainly is conclusive by 1961. The problem was, the U-2 prior to the time it was shot down in May of 1960 and the satellites for a long time thereafter were top secret. So Eisenhower could not reveal the sources of his sense of reassurance that we were not seriously behind. So he was forced into simply reassuring the American people, saying, trust me, I know what I'm talking about. And that was not wholly credible at the time. Historians, however, do give him a lot of credit, I think, now, for not having allowed this to produce a much larger arms race than, in fact, it did.
So then we should remember this because Eisenhower limited rather than completely quashed any kind of popular hysteria.
Well, he certainly tried to, and he was not entirely successful in crushing this. But what's really important to remember is that the big American missile buildup is something that occurs in the Kennedy administration. After the Kennedy administration knows full well that we are ahead, Eisenhower kept the actual number of missiles that we were building under pretty reasonable control. So this is still a puzzle for historians as to why Kennedy insisted on building missiles that we really didn't need. And Eisenhower is, I think, respected for the restraint that he showed.
One of the things that you mentioned very briefly was the fact that American satellite reconnaissance and U-2 reconnaissance helped us to understand the actual capabilities of the Soviet Union. Did Sputnik itself really provide the impetus, or was it the opening of the door, so to speak, for satellite reconnaissance? And could we say that that may be one of the greatest legacies of Sputnik?
No, satellite reconnaissance was in the works even before Sputnik. You can take it all the way back to Eisenhower's proposal for an open skies inspection plan at the Geneva Conference in 1955, the first of the post-war summit conferences. And the public version of that proposal was aerial reconnaissance, reconnaissance by airplanes. But we know now that Eisenhower had already discussed with scientists and had been thinking about the possibility of satellite reconnaissance. So I think the satellite reconnaissance program didn't so much critically depend on Sputnik. It was in the works before then. It just took a long time to perfect it, and particularly to perfect the means of retrieving the film capsules, which is what they had to do in those early days, and that took a long time.
I don't want to have to belabor that, but I am curious to know, do you think that because the Soviets were the first to launch Sputnik, and I recall the transcripts from the Paris conference in 1960 where Nikita Khrushchev says that my satellites are flying overhead, and De Gaulle points out and says, how come we can't be sure that there are no cameras in there taking pictures as the American spy planes were?
Right.
And Khrushchev says, well, as God is my witness, there are not. Is it possible that by virtue of having the Soviet Union launch the first satellite, that it really gave a sense of legitimacy to Eisenhower's commitment for an American spy satellite program so that this could take place and be able to point our fingers back at the Soviet Union and say, you did this first?
Yes, but I don't think that was really that much of an uphill battle, because I think in the context of the Cold War, Eisenhower would not have had to worry too much about that issue. What is interesting about Eisenhower is that I think that one of the purposes of Open Skies in 1955, one of the purposes of trying to get the Russians to acknowledge the legitimacy of overhead reconnaissance as a principle in international law, is that Eisenhower is looking ahead to reconnaissance satellites. And for a brief period after the satellites went up, as you suggest with the comment about De Gaulle and Khrushchev, that did become an interesting issue once the Russians got their own reconnaissance satellites up, which happens about 1962. They see enough value in this that they're not prepared to make this an issue in international law, and they choose not to treat it in the same way that they did in the two as fine.
Would it be fair then to say, bringing the reconnaissance portion of Sputnik's legacy to a close, would it be fair then to consider that the Soviets had just as much interest not only in advancing their own reconnaissance satellite program, but couldn't we understand that the Soviets actually benefited from having this satellite reconnaissance in both directions, sort of a way to allay concerns about Potemkinism, and that it really was a growing Soviet military capability?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to do as a Soviet leader. If what you're trying to do is to stabilize the arms race, which later Soviet leaders surely were trying to do, and Khrushchev in his own bumbling way may have been trying to do this, yes, we can see now that transparency was a very stabilizing force. We could not have the SALT agreements without satellite reconnaissance. But you have to remember that Khrushchev is not all that clear on this. Khrushchev knows that the Soviet Union is behind. He's trying to bluff his way with this Potemkin village of missiles that don't exist. And the advent of reconnaissance satellites blows him out of the water on that score. The whole strategy depended on keeping Soviet capabilities opaque, not transparent. So from his short-term perspective, it was a disaster. And the development of our reconnaissance capabilities by way of the U-2 and then by way of satellites. In the long run, it was a triumph, I think, for stability and rationality in the arms race.
One of the key ideas of Sputnik is that it's a technological, a scientific, or a physical accomplishment that's first, an achievement that the United States did not succeed. And we've looked at this more or less from a national security perspective. As you know, the following year is the International Geophysical Year, the IGY. How did Sputnik play as sort of a way for the Soviet Union to become the pioneer, the leader in the IGY as the recognized forefront of scientific accomplishment, particularly in space?
Well, I think in a curious kind of way, the IGY actually may have delayed the American satellite, because the Americans were treating the development of satellites at this point in a fairly leisurely way, as much as a scientific enterprise as anything else. Although Eisenhower is interested in the possibility of military reconnaissance, it's not a crash program until Sputnik goes up, and IGY was one of the reasons for that. We simply were looking at it as science. Khrushchev clearly sees the prestige potential in this, which Eisenhower did not. And he's able to have it both ways. He's able to achieve a scientific breakthrough, do it first, but at the same time do something that has immense strategic Cold War significance for his country.
How did this play out in the terms of culture? I've often joked that people joined slide rule clubs afterwards and gave up their hot rods in the glee club. Do you think that it really affected American culture to the degree that most of the common men and women of the United States suddenly realized that there needed to be a greater emphasis on science, on education, on engineering skills?
Well, it was one of the best things that happened to the universities because the National Defense Education Act was passed shortly after this, partly in the wake of the momentum of this crisis. There was very much the sense that we were behind in scientific and technological training, which in retrospect may not have been true, but the U.S. government does pour an immense amount of money into the universities, into science in the wake of this. So that effect was surely there.
How would you summarize for our listeners, if you would, the real legacy of Sputnik? You, in your work, have done a great deal of research to show the then and now idea. Then we understood this, now we know this. How would you characterize the legacy of Sputnik, both in terms of what we used to believe and what we should believe now?
Well, I think that there are a couple of legacies that are worth mentioning. One is that it's the beginning of the process by which we shift our sense of secrecy. The old idea had been that it was to the advantage of both sides to keep things secret. With Sputnik, and particularly with the advent of reconnaissance satellites coming in the early 60s, both sides do begin to see by that 1963 that transparency could actually be stabilizing in the arms race. So I think that that's one legacy of it. The other legacy, which strikes me, particularly struck me as I was working on this new book, is that Khrushchev's strategic Potemkinism, this strategy of bluffing that he fell into as a result of the Sputnik achievement, had a powerfully divisive effect on his own alliances, because he could not let the Americans know, of course, that he didn't have the missiles that he claimed to have, but he could not let his allies know that either, and allies like Ulbricht in East Germany and Mao in China, we now know, were pushing Khrushchev to become a lot more belligerent because they took quite literally the claims that he was making. So Sputnik is tied in with the origins of the Berlin crisis of 1958-61, and I think it's even tied in to some extent with the origins of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Khrushchev is being put under pressure to put up or shut up with these claims that he's making. And in this sense, we can say that in the short run, the effect of it was quite dangerous, and even in the long run, we can see the stabilizing legacies here.
Well, thank you, Professor Gaddis. In fact, I'm very appreciative for that last remark, because for so many people, Sputnik was just a new issue in the space race and a new example of technology. And in fact, we can see its consequences for Berlin, Cuba, the Sino-Soviet split, and others. Again, that was Professor John Lewis Gaddis. His most recent book, We Now Know, Rethinking Cold War History, is published by Oxford University Press. Few events in Cold War history so closely linked to national security, popular culture, education, and technology as did Sputnik. The Soviet satellite, beeping overhead every 95 minutes, could easily have been a Soviet atomic bomb, accentuating American vulnerability to a surprise attack, a legacy of Pearl Harbor. That the Soviets were first to orbit a satellite reflected their greater commitment to science and education than what existed in the United States, where high school and college students eschewed physics and engineering for business classes and hot rods. Finally, if Sputnik proved to be the origin of the space race, epitomized by President John F. Kennedy's national pledge to put a man on the moon before the end of the 1960s, then so too did Sputnik accelerate the arms race, provoking an exhaustive American effort to develop, build, and deploy ballistic missiles to counter those of the Soviet Union. All this from a tiny metal sphere, no bigger than a beach ball. To see a full-size replica of Sputnik, visit the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. You'll also see a number of other exhibits that explain the consequences of Sputnik on the space race and the arms race. If you're on the West Coast, plan to see the San Diego Aerospace Museum. Replicas of the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo capsules form the centerpiece of the museum's exhibit on the U.S. manned space program, a direct legacy of Sputnik.
Thank you, Robert. We'll look forward to seeing you again sometime soon. This is the part of our program, by the way, when we let historians speak their mind to provide their insights as historians into the events of the day. This week, we have Professor Norman Markowitz, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Professor Markowitz is a writer for the History News Service, and his topic is the so-called American welfare state.
When English economist Joan Robinson was asked in the early 1960s to comment on the welfare state in the U.S., she replied that there really wasn't any, since the hallmark of a welfare state was a system of universal health care, which then, as now, didn't exist in the United States. Why and how has the U.S. been so different from the rest of the Western world in its social welfare policy? First of all, the Western welfare state model provided a variety of subsidized social services to all citizens, not just those whose low incomes made them eligible. Health care was available to all as a matter of right, as was often free tuition, college education, public housing, paid maternity leaves, and family allowances. Also, the philosophy behind the Western welfare state was that health care, education, housing, transportation, and child-rearing subsidies would create a more productive labor force with more disposable income and more purchasing power, a society that would provide a series of shock absorbers to cope with depressions and other crises while eliminating the long-term destitution poverty that fueled social unrest. Compare this with the way welfare state has been defined in the U.S. as compassion for the poor by liberals or as a parasitic culture of dependency by conservatives. The Cold War does much to explain the U.S. divergence from the Western model. After World War II, a Social Security-style system of national health insurance proposed by President Truman was defeated by anti-New Deal conservatives in the Cold War atmosphere as, quote, creeping socialism, while a crazy quilt system of insurance company-administered health insurance that excluded millions was created. College education was paid for by student loans, public housing was turned into a dumping ground for the poor, and public transportation was sacrificed for highway construction. By the 1960s, this alternate course of development, which one might call an installment plan state, was rapidly producing what economist John Kenneth Galbraith called a society of private wealth and public squalor. Even with the 1960s Great Society's attempt to launch a war on poverty, welfare remained something unconnected to the great majority of people, except as an expression of their guilt for the suffering of the poor, or among anti-Great Society conservatives, their rage at what they saw as big government rewarding the unproductive in society. Unlike Western welfare state societies, welfare became, in the U.S., after the collapse of the Great Society, a segregated and stigmatized noun for segregated and stigmatized people. I am not suggesting that in a multicultural society, only Western models deserve serious attention. However, the failure of public media to explore the Western welfare state model and the U.S. divergence from it has seriously deformed political debate and contributed to the demonologizing of welfare, especially among those who see themselves as defending Western values.
Once again, that was Professor Norman Markowitz of Rutgers University giving his historical perspective on what has come to be known as the American welfare state. And with that, we've once again come to the end of our show. As always, if you have any comments to offer, any questions to raise, any topics to suggest for future programs, send them to us either by email at talkinghistory, all one word, at creightonuniversity.edu, or by the regular mail routes at Talking History, two words, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And that's it for this week's Talking History. From Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau.